Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I am an assistant director with RTP and the Federalist Society's practice groups and networks. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Today, we are joined by a great group of tech and legal experts to discuss the recent executive order issued by President Donald Trump entitled Ensuring a National Policy Framework for Artificial Intelligence. Our speakers today include Professor Kevin Frazier, AI Innovation and Law Fellow at the University of Texas School of Law, Neil Chilson, Head of AI Policy at the Abundance Institute, and Charlie Bullock, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute for Law and AI. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Kevin, I will hand things over to you to start us off.
Well, Libby, thank you for the opportunity. And Neil and Charlie, thanks so much for joining. If I had to select a fantasy team of AI policy experts, I think each of you would be among my top draft picks. I'm not going to say which one of you would have been first. Sorry. But thank you for joining. Charlie, I want to start off with you and just try to go all the way back, which feels like years, if not decades ago, to the start of 2025. What was the sort of AI policy landscape as we were leaving the Biden administration and coming into the Trump administration?
Well, you had the Biden executive order on AI that had been issued in October 2023. And that did a number of different things. It purported to establish reporting requirements for frontier systems and stuff like that. That's no longer with us. It got the axe under the Trump administration. You had much less, I would say, state AI policy. SB 53 had not been enacted into law yet, which is California's transparency law. The RAISE Act had not yet been enacted into law. That's New York's frontier AI transparency law. You did have Colorado's 2024 law. Colorado, it's a sort of an algorithmic discrimination law. And that was causing problems then, and it's still causing problems now. So it was a lot has happened during the year. It's been a hectic one.
It's been one heck of a year. And Neil, if you could help clarify, again, trying to get a sense of how we ended up with this EO and how we've ended up with our current AI regulatory posture, what were we expecting from the Trump administration at the outset of 2025? And we'll get to how that's manifested over the course of the year, but what were some of the early expectations from what we would see from the Trump administration?
Well, I think what we expected was a bit of a directional change, a big directional change. I think that Trump during the campaign, and especially some of his lieutenants during the campaign, had signaled that they thought Biden was wrong on a bunch of things, obviously. But we very quickly saw, as day one, the repeal of the Biden executive order and then some follow-up executive actions very quickly after that. And so I think expectations were that there would directionally be a change. I don't know that people were kind of concerned about how it would play out, because this is not a particularly politicized issue yet. And I think even within the Republican Party, there are tensions about how to approach technology overall, especially since many of the companies involved have social media arms that had been under a lot of fire, obviously, from certain wings of the Conservative Party. So it wasn't obvious what the full approach would be, but I think overall it has really been a big directional change from the Biden administration, which was an approach based on primarily safety, to an approach that's very much emphasizing the need for the U.S. to dominate in this technology. So very, very different perspectives, even if sometimes in the details there is some agreement.
And what I think is worth highlighting there is, if we went back to 2024 and we did an exit poll of all the voters, I don't think we would have identified any AI voters, right? You know, you hear about an immigration voter or you hear about an economy voter. I don't think anyone was leaving the polls saying, yes, my decision was dictated by AI for these reasons. And even today, something that was startling to look at was Axios did a summary of news coverage of the most important topics over the course of the year. And two topics were at the fore. Inflation, which was great. We saw kind of sustained coverage of inflation throughout the entire year. Makes sense. Sounds like an issue that we should all care about. Second, Labubu. And if you're thinking, what the heck is Labubu, you're asking the right question. It's the sort of thing we shouldn't be talking about at all. But I think it's worth emphasizing that when we're talking about AI, this is still just such a new issue and not necessarily an issue that's the number one, number two, or even number 11 priority issue for American voters. And so, Charlie, as the year started to unfold, you mentioned earlier that we saw in California in 2024, there were some nascent efforts at some pretty far-reaching AI legislation. But then in 2025, California, New York, Illinois all saw some pretty substantive AI legislation. What do you think gave rise to this increased attention to AI at the state level? What issues are really motivating state legislators on this front?
Yeah, well, I think you're right to point out that there aren't a lot of just AI one-issue voters, right? It doesn't motivate voters in the same way that issues like immigration sometimes do, or even something like climate change, right? Where there are people who are just, that's their issue, and they vote solely based on it. You know, I might be the only AI voter in the United States, or maybe the three of us.
There we go. Well, yeah, we've got three right here. We'll be the other category for a while.
That said, I mean, that the fact that it's not anyone's number, that it's not most people's number one issue doesn't mean that it's not important, right? There are well-funded and also well-organized constituencies, interest groups that support both AI legislation and that oppose AI legislation, right? So, for example, Alex Boris, the New York State congressman who sponsored the RAISE Act, and Scott Wiener, the California state legislator who sponsored SB 53, these two transparency bills, both have decided to run for Congress federally and have both raised sort of record-breaking, I think, amounts of money because of the sort of interest by, you know, well-moneyed and well-organized groups behind these issues, right? So that we can expect that to motivate future legislators. Hey, look, if I make this my issue, I can also become, you know, one of the best funded campaigns in the history of, you know, the United States Congress or something like that. Likewise, you know, the opposition is also, you know, extremely well-funded, extremely well-organized, right? Andreessen Horowitz is a venture capital fund that has dedicated, I think, $100 million, along with some other people, Greg Brockman from OpenAI, to a super PAC opposing AI legislation, right? So that's the kind of money, right, that can make politicians sit up and listen, right? The crypto industry had a lot of success, just throwing huge amounts of money and good organization at, you know, basically trying to make sure that crypto was regulated or not regulated in the way that they wanted. And that was extremely successful. They you know, torpedoed the campaigns of some politicians who were doing things they didn't like crypto-wise, and they really supported the campaigns of some politicians who did do what they wanted crypto-wise. So I think there's it's pretty clear why politicians at the state level and at the federal level would want to put their hats in this ring. And also, it's an issue with increasing salience, I would say, right? As the technology develops and gets better, right? People pay more and more attention, right? As it starts to have, you know, maybe real effects on the employment market, that's something, if you start losing your jobs, right, people pay attention to that. Already, you know, you have sort of battles between automated car companies and people who like riding around in automated cars, like myself, and people who drive for a living and don't want to lose that job, right? Perhaps understandably. So this is as the technology continues to improve, its salience continues to increase, and I think we can expect to see more and more voters actually having their votes affected by AI policy.
And that attention to the issue certainly did manifest in a lot of state proposals. I think, depending on who you ask, let's just minimally say there were hundreds, in some cases, under some measurements, thousands of state AI-related bills. Neil?
Thousand, singular. Huh? 1,000 singular. There's like 1,300, right? So.
Yeah.
Well, technically, that's more than 1,000 if we're going to really parse words.
Yeah, just kidding.
So, Neil, for the folks who weren't waking up and checking different state legislative proposals and getting a sense of what was happening at the committee level, can you give us a landscape of what sorts of AI policies we saw at the state level? And what were the state AI bills that raised so much opposition that Charlie was mentioning earlier and kind of gave rise to making this perhaps a national issue and an issue that was certainly at the top of mind of the White House?
Well, I think the first one wasn't actually this year. It was in 2024. It was SB 1047. And that was the one that I think sort of set the tone for how some of these most aggressive regulatory regimes that are about the model development, just the raw building of an artificial intelligence model, how that regulatory fight would line up. And so we saw some dialed back versions of those in 2025. SB 53 in some ways is a model level regulation, but it's much different than 1047, even though Scott Wiener introduced both. It is much more about transparency than it is about specific requirements on how you develop. Similarly, Alex Borres's law proposal in New York looked more regulatory in the way that it was passed by the legislature, but then it received some chapter amendments by the governor as she signed it just in the waning days of 2025. That really do dial it back, make it look a lot more like SB 53. And so that's one category. I would say those AI model regulation are one type of category. The other type of category, Charlie alluded to this, are the sort of algorithmic discrimination laws. There is a wide range of those. And at the very beginning of this year, you saw the Texas bill go from something that looked very much like Colorado's bill to its final passage, which looked very different. It's much more of a transparency bill. Again, did not look like that algorithmic transparency effect. That's still going on in Colorado. I think a lot of people are still looking at that and waiting to see like how exactly Colorado navigates that. They've had a difficult time trying to figure out how to implement it. And they've gotten a lot of pushback from unusual parties, including, you know, some state implementers of AI who want to use it, say, in the education space, who are like, are we going to be on the hook for, you know, potential lawsuits if we use this technology under this law? We saw another bill in that category would be the bill in Connecticut that I think was introduced, did not even get passed through the Senate there. And so I think the sponsor there is very much looking at how to re-up that in 2026 in a way that matches maybe some of the other more limited laws. And then you have a wide range of laws that are, technology specific. You have continuing work in the sort of biometric space. You had a bunch of laws, although I think we'll have a lot more in 2026, that focus just on chatbots. And these are driven, I think, a lot by the concerns around, especially kids' interactions with chatbots. But some of the other types of stories that have come out from people who are mentally unwell, who are using these tools and do things that are harmful to themselves or others. And so I think you're seeing that motivation. The big challenge there is, you know, how do you define a chatbot as distinct from, you know, a lot of the other AI tools that we're using? I think the states are engaging with that. And, you know, we saw in California, one chatbot bill pass and one chatbot bill get vetoed by the governor, in part due to these difficulties in figuring out what the scope of the law applies to. And so I think those are like three of the major categories. There's a whole other set of categories that are in many ways less problematic that have more to do with, say, government use of AI, where the government is saying like, hey, let's figure out how we use this, both maybe how do we set limits on how we use it in law enforcement, for example, but also how do we use it to make government services more efficient? All of those make sense, I think, and there are the types of things that are well within the state's authority and competency to deal with. And so I think we'll continue to see some of those sort of good government types of bills. But the range is wide, in part because artificial intelligence is a general purpose technology. It touches basically in every industry. And I think we will continue to see bills that maybe we would have called something else, say privacy bills, or maybe we would have just called them governance bills of some other type of industry, start having AI components or maybe even being called AI bills because it raises the prominence of the legislation, to Charlie's point. And it, you know, maybe it raises some dollars for the legislators as well.
We've certainly seen all of the colors of the AI rainbow be painted by various state legislators. And I think to your point, Neil, we should expect that to continue in 2026, and we'll hit on that in a second. But I want to shift our gaze to the federal level, because while there wasn't as much activity at the state, at the federal level as there was at the state level, there were certainly some interesting debates that were occurring in Congress, to put things lightly. So, Charlie, starting off in 2025, we know that this issue had been studied by Congress. We saw a bipartisan study effort by the House, for example, under Representatives Obernolte and, under Representatives Obernolte. I'm so sorry, Congressman, if you're listening to this. Just know that I know your name and I'm doing my best. Representative Liu also was behind that bipartisan House task force. They outlined myriad regulatory proposals that had bipartisan consensus. We also saw earlier the Senate AI Insight Forums that led to a lot of interesting discourse and a very high-level framework for AI policy here. But as 2025 got underway, things didn't appear to be going towards some sort of comprehensive, specific AI legislation from Congress. What have we seen over the course of the year, Charlie, in terms of the substance and intentions of congressional activity with respect to AI?
Yeah, so we've seen a lot of proposals, right? There have been a lot of AI bills proposed. Now, the base rate for passing legislation is very low, right? Because we have a highly polarized Congress these days. The filibuster is a powerful tool, right? And so it's just very rare that any bill gets passed unless it's in some sort of must-pass legislation, such as the NDAA or such as, you know, reconciliation budget stuff. So those were sort of two flashpoints during the year. We had a reconciliation bill, the One Big Beautiful Bill, and there was an attempt to put preemption, right, of state AI laws in that. There was not a lot of attempts to put affirmative AI policy in it, but there was an attempt to preempt state laws. That was unsuccessful ultimately, although it was a close thing. Later in the year, we had the NDAA. There was another attempt to put preemption in that, and that didn't succeed. But there was in the NDAA, it looks like there are going to be a number of AI provisions included in it, most of which authorized the Department of Defense to do different things. So national security related things in the NDAA, which the public, you know, may never know about because it's national security, it's intelligence. So it'll all be done in closed rooms. But it does look like there's some, you know, reasonably significant or meaningful things happening there. And then there were a ton of proposals, none of which really seemed to have made it that far, right? One of my favorites is the AI Whistleblower Protection Act, right, which Senator Grassley sponsored. He's a big supporter of whistleblowers. That I thought that might have legs because Senator Jay Obernolte, who's generally a big supporter of preemption, sponsored the House version of that. So I thought, there was some talk that maybe there would be an ability to strike a deal between people who really are worried about state overregulation and people who want affirmative federal policy. Some kind of deal could be struck to get some sort of preemption in exchange for some sort of federal policy. That didn't end up happening. We could speculate, we could talk about why that didn't end up happening, but it hasn't happened yet. Maybe it'll happen in 2026, maybe not. But there were a ton of AI bills proposed and very few passed. I think they passed one on deepfakes is the one that I remember being passed. But other than that, that one on deepfakes, not a lot of affirmative federal AI policy made it. But, Senator Blackburn, Marsha Blackburn, who's very interested in AI policy, just proposed a sort of like greatest hits compilation of AI bills. It incorporates like 17 different proposals. Senator Hawley's made about a trillion different proposals over the course of the year. It'll keep on going. And if you take enough swings, maybe eventually something passes. Maybe there's something that there's sufficient bipartisan interest to get some federal policy done. But yeah, so far, it's been a lot more fun, I think, for both sides to play defense than to play offense, because you always win when you're playing defense. You always, we stopped them from passing their law. But
lots of defense going on here. And I think the Senator Blackburn proposal, I've been thinking of it as a sort of 2025 AI wrapped, where yep. Just looking at every AI policy that may fit into a good playlist and moving forward with it. And to your point, Charlie, maybe that cobbles together enough votes that leads to some consensus here. But Neil, we're trying to get a sense of who are the different coalitions in these fights. And for folks who, again, aren't in the weeds of AI policy, they perhaps might be confused because they hear from, for example, Assemblymember Boras and Senator Wiener that, yes, there are certain issues we want Congress to act on. And we'll hear this from the state level. We'll hear this from some Republicans, some good Democrats saying, yes, there's a role for the federal government to play. Why aren't we seeing Congress step into that void? What have been some of the main sticking points for getting to 50 or 60?
I mean, honestly, I think the main sticking point is nobody's quite sure which problem they're trying to solve. Like I said, artificial intelligence is a very general purpose technology. The coalitions are worried about very different things. So you have the AI Safety Coalition, which is primarily worried about, you know, these models causing harm, the models themselves causing some types of harms. Their emphasis is very much on innovation, but with guardrails around these specific, you know, the training of the most powerful frontier models. You have groups that are, I would say, more on the classic AI regulation front. They have a long history of being concerned about the socioeconomic effects of technology overall. And they're generally skeptical in many ways about markets delivering benefits, and they think that there should be, they almost always are encouraging more government regulation in this space, but it's not about frontier models. It's usually about the applications and the implementation of them. That's a very different coalition. They want something very different. They kind of look more like the groups that have long supported, you know, strong privacy regulation. And so, you have that coalition. And then you obviously you have industry, but industry is a lot of different players here in this space. And because AI is a general purpose technology, you have everybody from companies who are trying to defend their status quo position from disruption, and then companies who are trying to disrupt that. And so industry has very different perspectives on how to do this. And all of these groups are looking at federal and state and saying, like, where are we most likely to get the things that we want? I think the most obvious winners from a sort of state patchwork is that middle group that I talked about, the people who are generally worried about the implementation effects of technology. They have long had a substantive and really tight connections with state regulators. And I think they're looking at this and they're seeing, we'll just repeat the privacy playbook where we'll have 50 different state laws about privacy. And that generally serves their purposes. And so I think the other parties are still trying to figure out where exactly their interests best lie. And I think that's going to be a big dynamic in 2026 is seeing how those different coalitions line up for different types of AI regulation, depending on what Congress comes out with and depending on how the states continue to move forward.
Yeah. And I think there's so much uncertainty here too, in terms of how AI is adopted by whom and to what ends. Some things that I think are worth pointing out, according to a recent Gallup poll, just 10% of US workers use AI on a daily basis. And fewer than 9% of U.S. small firms are actually using AI. And perhaps my favorite recent news story, Politico just outlined that Senator Warren is now using AI and has acknowledged some positive benefits. And so there's just so much we don't even know yet about some of the pros and cons of this technology that may force different issues to the fore or may move or shuffle the pieces otherwise. But Charlie, did you have some commentary on how these coalitions are playing out that you wanted to add in there?
Sure. Yeah. I just want to plant a flag early and make my position on the patchwork issue known. Right. So as I see it, right. And I think you both might disagree with me. There is a possibility that in the future, there could be a patchwork of state regulations that, hinders innovation and so forth. I view that as a speculative fear, right? Not that it's unreasonable, but that it does not yet exist, right? I think in terms of like onerous state AI regulations that currently like have been passed, I think it's Colorado's bill, which like has not yet gone into law and may never go into law. And then, you know, I don't view like the RAISE Act and SB 53 and stuff like that as necessarily, first of all, they're it looks like very harmonized, right? They're essentially the same law. So you can you know, send two emails to two different addresses with the same document attached, and then you've complied with both laws. And I also don't think they're highly burdensome, right? It's pretty light touch stuff. So I would push back against the claim that there's like currently a patchwork of state laws that's placing compliance burdens on companies or something like that.
Neil, did you want to jump in there at all in terms of whether or not a patchwork currently exists?
I mean, we obviously have a patchwork. I mean, we have a patchwork now. The question is how burdensome is it? I think there's a lot of companies who are just not paying attention to the laws yet. But the first time a startup has to be like to a law firm, like, hey, what's my legal liability here? Yeah. We can run that bill. That's going to be expensive for every single company, right? Like, now maybe complying with those laws turns out like the lawyer says, hey, you know, you're pretty safe here for the most part. You don't do X, Y, and Z. You might have to like dial back in this state. You might have to do something custom in this state. Maybe that's not super expensive, but even the question, I think we underestimate how burdensome that is to startups to have to be like, hey, I'm used to just writing software and then people being able to download it. Now I have to write software and ask for a 50-state survey of whether or not my law affects that. And, you know, I think some places like Law AI are going to provide great resources to companies who are curious about that. But I do think that it will be a challenge for them. And but to Charlie's point, I think he's right that we're still in the early days of this, right? Like, I don't think the trend has peaked in what states are trying to do in this space. And we saw that in the privacy fight, right? The state privacy laws still continue to become more burdensome. California's algorithmic, discrimination or algorithmic decision-making rulemaking, which is based on their privacy law, essentially is a sort of rulemaking about AI based on a privacy law in California. And so I think we'll continue to see the states do more. And so the question is, what are they the right actors to be doing this? When is it the right time for Congress to step in? Maybe not all of it has come to realization, but the seeds are strongly planted. The trees are growing. To mix my metaphors, the canopy of the patchwork canopy is coming. I guess
it's getting chaotic, Neil. I'm going to have to cut you off. I do think though. To your point, Neil, and I think there's a rightful acknowledgement here that it's somewhat to be determined in terms of just how onerous some of these bills are, what it looks like from the perspective of startups, while also acknowledging even a change in a privacy policy for a startup, according to research by Engine and the Michigan Public Policy School, can cost a startup upwards of $6,000 in legal expenses. So even those kind of low-hanging changes to just your normal in and out of complying with certain laws can be quite onerous. But Charlie, we've talked about Congress, we've talked about the states, and we finally teed ourselves up for this most recent AI executive order. So can you just walk us through what are some of the core provisions as you read the document and what you think this executive order is really intending to achieve?
Yeah, sure. First of all, an executive order is not a law, right? That's important to understand. People who listen to your Scaling Laws podcast are already aware of this. You guys covered this. But an executive order, what it does is it's essentially a memo to other parts of the executive branch from the president, who's the head of the executive branch, saying, hey, here's what I want you to do. And the president does have authority to do that. What he does not have authority to do, and what the executive order on AI does not purport to do, is actually like preempt state laws, right? So there's no preemption in the executive order. But what it does do is it tries to make it easier to preempt state laws in the future, and it tries to make it... put various barriers in the way to states enforcing or implementing or even enacting perhaps state AI laws. So it starts out with two sort of prefatory policy statements, which are like, hey, here's what we think, AI dominance, you know, we want to beat China, et cetera, et cetera. We don't like algorithmic discrimination laws. We don't like wokeness, the stuff you'd expect pretty much from the administration. Interestingly enough, originally it specifically mentioned transparency laws. The leaked draft that leaked about in November specifically called out like SB 53 from California as an example of undesirable law. That was removed, right? So there you can see some behind the scenes wrangling between sort of the David Sachs, Silicon Valley elements of the conservative coalition and perhaps, right, some sort of more populist MAGA type, like tech skeptical pro-regulation elements, right? Where they took out the specific indictment of SB 53. So leaving open the possibility that maybe laws like that are acceptable. Then in section three, the executive order directs the U.S. Attorney General to establish within the Department of Justice a litigation task force, an AI litigation task force, which is going to sue states that have undesirable AI laws if they're unlawful or, you know, in the Attorney General's judgment or whatever. They specifically call out the Dormant Commerce Clause, right? States with impermissible extraterritorial effects as one legal theory under which they'll challenge state AI laws. And they specifically also mention state laws that are preempted by existing regulations. Then there's a section that directs the Department of Commerce to publish sort of a list of bad state AI laws. Then there's a section five, which I think is perhaps the most important or potentially impactful section, which says, okay, if you have undesirable AI laws, first of all, NTIA is going to withhold BEAD funds from you. So that's like broadband funds that are sort of earmarked for like states to put in broadband internet. There's about $21 billion of leftover BEAD funds that are going to be withheld from states, you know, purportedly according to this, if they regulate AI in a way that the White House doesn't like. And then section B says, okay, all other federal discretionary grant funds, and that's potentially hundreds of billions of dollars. We're going to take a look at that agency by agency and see what we can withhold from states that regulate AI in a way that we don't think is good. So that's potentially a lot of money being withheld from states. Again, it doesn't preempt state AI laws, but it could put a lot of pressure on states, especially sort of like less wealthy red states, I think, to like not that to not regulate AI, because like, you know, a blue state like California with a ton of money is going to have, you know, they have a political incentive. Gavin Newsom has a political incentive to look like he's fighting Trump. So the order probably makes him more likely to dig in his heels. But if you're, you know, West Virginia or something, and A, you're rural, you really need this broadband money. And B, like, you don't want to look like you're pushing back against President Trump. That could really prevent them from passing laws. And so then maybe instead of a patchwork, you just have California regulating for the whole country or something like that.
The good old Sacramento effect. But and I know there's a couple of other provisions to get to, and I'll circle back to those in a second. But Neil, in terms of thinking through some of the specific aspects of the impending AI litigation task force work, how do you expect that's going to play out in practice? What should we see or expect in 2026 with respect to this task force? Is there assumption that come January, we're going to see tons of complaints being filed across the country? Or is this going to be a sort of one by one slow process in your estimation?
Well, the first deadline of the executive order is the establishment of this task force. So I imagine we'll see announcements about it becoming an ongoing concern. I don't see this as probably like a flood of quick litigation. I expect DOJ will work with the Department of Commerce in identifying those state laws that seem both like the most problematic and the most vulnerable on legal grounds. And then they'll move forward on that front. You know, I think there's lots of other agencies. You know, the directive here isn't just to use Dormant Commerce Clause. It's also about using other laws that preempt. There are some other agencies referenced in the executive order, the FTC and the FCC. I think DOJ will work with them to see what the effects of their laws might be in this space as well. How much do they preempt? Where might they preempt? And then I think DOJ will think hard about, outside of, you know, Dormant Commerce Clause, what are some of the other tools that suggest that states shouldn't be setting national policy, other tools in the Constitution and in the litigation toolbox that say states shouldn't be setting national policy. I should say that this is an issue that is not just about AI. This is an issue that there are many people who have long had concerns about, say, California setting environmental standards that affect the entire country. And so I think there is an appetite for figuring out the proper way and what are the constitutional limits on states setting national policy. AI is just one of the areas that will play out. I think DOJ already has people thinking about this issue. I think they will think about it in a very concentrated way with AI as the poster child, and they'll work through it that way. And so I wouldn't expect fast action, but I would expect, you know, DOJ to develop some cases, to start working with other agencies and try to figure out where they can take action that both signals that President Trump cares about this, as he has made very clear both in his public statements and in this executive order. And then also, you know, signals to the states that they're going to face an additional cost if they willy-nilly pass AI laws, which, you know, to this point, they really haven't faced much costs. They face mostly benefits. You know, it's a great platform to run for national office on, apparently. So,
And it is hilarious in some of the immediate responses to this EO, the sort of acquiescence or normalcy that's become associated with the Sacramento effect. I think if the founders, for example, were to hear that we had normalized that term, it would probably be the subject of a lot of ire and debate, but we'll save a more deeper historical dive for a future pod. Charlie, on the converse, on the flip side, how quickly do you think we'll see states challenge, in particular, this funding aspect and the sort of discretionary possibility of the White House really limiting some funding to states that are in high need of those sorts of massive infrastructure investments?
Yeah, it remains to be seen, right? The White House has already withheld BEAD funds, you know, non-deployment BEAD funds, which are the funds that aren't directly related to actually putting broadband in the ground from states. And there was no lawsuit over that, right? And the statute that authorizes BEAD actually has some provisions that make it pretty hard to sue. So I guess we'll see. I would say it kind of depends on how fast the White House moves on this, right? If they put out, you know, their... if they put out their policy statement or whatever saying like, okay, we're withholding these funds from these states, then maybe you'll get a lawsuit. But I don't know exactly when that's going to happen. So 2026 seems reasonable, but when in 2026, I don't know. It could even be 2027 before you really see lawsuits. And lawsuits, as you know, take a long, long time. So there's potentially a chilling effect on state legislation. If you just, even if you think you'd ultimately win a lawsuit, having your funds held up for a while, you know, could be a big deal for states, and they might not want that. So that could additionally incentivize states not to pass bad AI legislation. Yeah.
And it could be a really interesting talking point in a lot of these midterm election conversations saying, why are you moving forward with this AI legislation and therefore inhibiting our ability to realize these funds? And now you have that sort of forcing mechanism, as you called out, Charlie, that's going to make this issue even more salient and interesting from a political science perspective. But I know folks have plenty of New Year's Eve exciting opportunities to go off to across Chicago and DC and Nebraska. And so I don't want to get in the way of everyone's fun plans. So Neil and Charlie, I want to come to you each with some things you'll be paying particular attention to in 2026. I think your insights on what we should expect from the state level, whether we're going to see any meaningful movement by Congress on this front, and then if there are any wild card scenarios from the White House perspective that we should be keeping in mind, in particular from a national security perspective. I'm keen to hear your thoughts. That's a huge assignment, but I am a law professor, so I get to do what I want in assigning homework. Neil, let's start with you. Is anything jumping to the fore for what you're going to be paying attention to in 2026?
Well, I think what's going to maybe dominate the news other than Labubu in 2026, I should say my six-year-old got two Labubus this Christmas.
So whoa, miss. Yeah, that is exciting times.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what the appeal is. I think mostly it's one of those things that people talk about it and it becomes true. But anyways, I think that that actually relates very well actually to the data center conversation. I think that's going to be huge. It's already triggers a lot of, it pulls a lot of coalitions together or interest groups together that have long been skeptical of technology and of building. And so I am going to pay a lot of attention to how much local and state regulators are focused on the building of data centers and the building of the energy necessary to provide those data centers. It's become very salient. It's a very local issue. So in some ways, there's a lot of limits to what the federal government can do here. And so there's some really interesting policy questions, but it's going to be a knife fight at the state and local level, frankly. So that's one big thing. I think where China goes in AI is going to be, is a major possibility for, you know, a sort of touchstone that might light off federal action, both in the executive branch and in Congress. If there are big announcements out of China about, you know, their ability to, you know, lap us on supply chain stuff, or if they continue to release open models that are very competitive with our open models or maybe even our closed models, I think that could really drive policy conversations in DC. It was only earlier this year that the DeepSeek stuff dropped. And I talked for weeks with Congress people who were like just trying to figure out what exactly that meant for how the US. So we could see some events like that. And then I think we'll continue to see a steady drumbeat of litigation of harms in this space. And I think we'll see a drumbeat about child protection laws in AI, both at the federal and the state level. I think we will also continue to see a lot of those laws in adjacent areas, the social media regulation, face very serious court challenges and maybe even be blocked. And I think that will have to inform how legislators move ahead with AI regulation that's directed at kids. And so those are three of the big trends that I'm paying attention to this year.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you're going to be staying busy with a lot of news surveys. And I think it is worth noting that the EO also included sort of an effort to move forward or at least outline what a national framework on AI could look like. And among the categories that the EO wanted excluded from that national framework were child safety, were state AI governance, and were local data center decision making. And so the knife fight might be pretty intense. In fact, I might even call it a sword fight. We'll just see how intense it gets. Charlie, Neil's going to be super busy. What are you going to be occupying yourself with in 2026?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting things going on. The ones that I'm looking at most are A, the idea of a some sort of preemption deal, right, between advocates for preemption of state AI laws and advocates for substantive federal AI policy, see if there's some sort of deal that could be reached there prior to the midterms, maybe after the midterms, if depending on how the midterms go, right, the coalitions that exist then will determine what that deal looks like, perhaps. I'm also interested in sort of the implementation of the executive order, especially Section 3, the litigation task force, and Section 5, the funding stuff. I'm looking forward to seeing how that develops and what direction federal agencies go in, what direction the Department of Justice goes in, and how this litigation turns out, if in fact litigation is brought. Now, that probably won't conclude in 2026 because litigation moves very slowly, but at least we'll get to see complaints and so forth, perhaps. Yeah, and then also I'm just interested in seeing how states continue to legislate, because I don't think we've seen the end of state legislation. I don't think they're going to take SB 53 and raise and say, okay, great, we did it. AI is now regulated. I think probably additional proposals are going to be made, hopefully proposals that don't burden innovation and that don't have any effect on startups like SB 53 and raise. Yeah, we'll see. And I'm looking forward to evaluating a lot of good and probably a few bad state AI proposals legislatively.
Well, I know the two of you will certainly stay busy. And before I let you go, Neil, one New Year's resolution. What's going to change about Neil in 2026?
Wow, that's a great question. I was just rereading an essay by a certain CEO of an AI company where he encourages people to figure out ways to scale themselves. And so I may be coming to you, Kevin, for advice as the ability to move beyond and have the networks and the structures and the outputs to have a bigger effect on the world. I think that's always my New Year's resolution. And there's always room to improve it. So that's probably where I'm aiming this year.
Well, we always need more cowbell and we always need more Neil. So I wish you all the best on that. And Charlie, how about yourself?
I like to set aspirational New Year's resolutions. I like to shoot for the stars and set unreachable goals. So my goal is to publish half as many pieces as Kevin Frazier does.
My gosh. Y'all, yeah, I need to podcast more frequently with the two of you. This is great. For what it's worth, my New Year's resolution, I want to talk to some more FedSoc chapters so that more folks know about AI. So if you're looking to fill a random speaking slot, I am keen to come to a city near you. And Libby, I got the great opportunity to go to Lincoln in 2025. So maybe I'll see you in Omaha at some point.
Oh,
Awesome. We're here for it. Well, thank you all so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights on a very interesting both national and state conversation. Thank you to our audience for tuning in today. And if you're interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society and with the Regulatory Transparency Project, you can check out our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.